The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
First though, it's a story of bust to boom. John Power now runs Aerogen, a hugely successful company in Galway that specialises in delivering drugs through aerosols in acute hospital settings. He has been inundated with orders since COVID-19 began. The company exports to over 70 countries and the products are used in 60 of the top 100 hospitals worldwide. He's a former EY European Entrepreneur of the Year too. But it's been an interesting journey for him to get there. John, you come from a London Irish background. Your parents were both emigrants from Galway in the 1950s. I presume for you growing up, Galway was a big part of your identity.
From once I was born, we spent the whole summer. My mother used to come back to the farm in Killannon and spend the whole summer there. So 6 to 8 weeks every year out in the lake fishing and doing all sorts of things and up in the fields. Yeah, it was real difference from London. It used to be, you know, you'd be on the underground 1 minute, the day later you'd be on the back of a horse going up the fields pulling a hay or something, you know.
What kind of work did your parents do?
My dad, he went working on the buildings over there. Actually, he worked for Murphy's. I only found out a few years back, but the big Murphy's, but only, I think at the time they had two or three lorries. And then his brother-in-law, who'd been over there a while, had a job as in a restaurant in off Percy Street, owned by a Greek Cypriot, but his wife was a Connemara woman. Long story, but my dad got a job there and ended up being the wine waiter and moved up through it and became manager and was manager there for about 20 years.
He must have learned a bit of Greek while he was there,
he did. Yeah, he had. It was probably unusual. He had a bit of the Irish, bit of the Greek, and English. So, yeah, it was funny. But it was the top Greek restaurant in London, and all the after film showings and what have you get a lot of the stars in there. And Peter O'Toole used to go in there a lot, so he got to know Peter O'Toole. Him and Peter O'Toole used to spend the odd evening out in London, having a few drinks. So. Yeah.
A long evening.
A long evening, but we always used to get tickets for all the premieres when Peter O'Toole's films would be on in London, up in the city. We'd go up as kids, you know.
So for you growing up with that huge Galway connection, I'm sure it was part of the family identity and your identity.
Yeah, so we really grew up in a total Irish society in London, and I don't know if there were any English teachers. They were all Irish, and I'd say 95% of the kids were either Irish-born or of Irish parents. And my mother used to say to us as kids, I remember her saying, you know, John, remember we're only visitors in this country, because she was always, like all immigrants, sure she was going to moved back to Ireland. You know, it took a lot longer than she probably thought, but she finally got back there, yeah.
Now, you decided, as soon as you got a chance, really, to move to Galway. That was something that was always there for you that you wanted to do.
Yeah, it seemed a very natural thing for me. It didn't. It was something I always planned to do. I never considered really anything else other than moving to Galway.
So after you got married, yourself and your wife decided, that's it, Galway.
Yeah, well, I was lucky. My wife's family were from Ireland as well. So she was of the same inclination to move to Ireland. It took us a bit longer than we intended. I think we had two children, and then we were going to move over and she was expecting a baby, and there was a sort of housing crash in London and we couldn't sell what the place we had. So we waited until the third child came along and then we went. So we went over with, I think, three under four.
So how did you decide where to move to then? Was that a topic of conversation?
Yeah, it was, because I would have liked to have, in all honesty, Uachtaráid I knew so well, but I didn't think it'd be a good idea just planting my wife in amongst all my family. So I thought maybe my Cullen, which is next parish is Killannon, next parish is Uachtaráid. So I thought, well, my Cullen would be handy. It's only 10 minutes into Galway and everything. And I hadn't realised...
You didn't go too far, John.
No. And I hadn't realised until after moving there, but both my grandmothers were my Cullen women. So it ended up, we were still, loads of family in my Cullen, loads of relations. And Patrick was the eldest. He was four and he went straight into the Nenra, which was, my Cullen is Gaeltacht, so it was all Irish speaking. So he went from kind of a London, what would you call it, nursery school into the all-Irish speaking Nenra. It didn't bother him at all. He just got on with it and was speaking Irish with it. We didn't know what he was saying half the time, of course. But he came home and was telling us about all his cousins he'd met at Nenra. And we thought it was just a nice way of welcoming that everyone was being friendly, calling their cousins. But they actually were his cousins. So it was very funny, yeah.
Now, with your own schooling back in London, you left school at 16?
Yeah, 16, yeah. I don't know how I lasted there that long. I was...
Was it that bad?
No, I liked it. We went to an all... It was a Jesuit college in London. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. They taught us, for example, we learnt about Hinduism and, you know, different faiths. And but I was more interested in earning money, to be honest. I wanted to get out and, you know, earn a living.
And what was the plan when you left? What did you want to do?
Well, I was already work. Most of my family in London were on the buildings, and so I used to work from out in the building sites when I was very young, 15, you know, and it was used to earn a few bob, and so I just wanted to get in a job that paid good money. So I got an apprenticeship, I suppose you'd call it in them days, as a junior draftsman with the big old drawing boards, you know, with vellum and ink and everything. And yeah, that was an eye-opener, because I thought I was very good at it. And the first day I went there, the chap in charge of the office gave me a sheet of paper and a pencil, and he said, start writing your letter A out, uppercase, lowercase. And I said, how many? And he says, until I tell you to stop. And then it was letter B and then letter C and letter D, and because they wouldn't let you near the drawing boards or the old drawings unless your calligraphy was good enough.
Sounds like old school, doing it the hard way. But then you trained as an engineer. You studied yourself after that.
Yeah, well, I figured, I mean, very good. You see, in them days... going as an apprentice, you or a junior draftsman or whatever, you were sent to day school and night school. It was great because you learnt on the job and you earned a few bob, and that allowed you to get an engineer's job then.
As you moved on through your career, you got into robotics. Is that right?
That was a lucky break I got, because when I finished the course... there wasn't exactly companies out there looking for robotics or automation engineers, but one company did appear. There was, and it was a startup by an American and an English guy who'd, Tim Jones. He used to work for Clive Sinclair, who was really the great innovator in the UK at the time. I think the first electric car and ZX Spectrum. Tim worked for him, and he specialised in automation and androids. And in fact, the company's name was the original Android company. And then it changed to Universal Machine Intelligence. And I mean, you couldn't help but love to work for a company that had great names like that, right?
Was it difficult to raise money, though, for a business like that?
We got funded, I remember, by one of the banks, Cazenove Bank in the city. The company was set up to develop the first home robot, can you believe? Now, this is 35 years ago, say. I remember we had this banker coming to see about our next round of finance for the company. And so Tim and I spent the whole weekend working out this presentation. And it was all very technical presentation on the robot's capabilities, how it worked, and triangulation for vision systems. And the guy came along. He was there in his three-piece suit and tie, and everything came in and sat down. And Tim started talking away. And I guess after about 5 minutes, your man put his hand up and he said, Tim, old chap, this sounds absolutely fascinating. He said, but I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. And this is the truth now, and people will find this hard to believe. But he said, I'll tell you what, he says. He said, next round of financing, he said, if you can get this robot to pour me a gin and tonic, and I'll come back 3 weeks' time. If it pours the gin and tonic, I'll give you the next round of financing. And that was the truth. And that's what... So we dropped everything and spent the next couple of weeks working on this robot, coming into a room, coming up to a docking station, picking up a bottle of Boost gin and pouring a gin and having a slice of lemon on a stick and dropping it. It was hilarious, but we got funded.
Did the robot do it?
Oh, it did, yeah. Yeah, no, we I mean, this robot, it was way ahead of it.
Could it do anything else, John?
Well, the computer power wasn't there. If you'd open up this robot, it was about the size of the old Dalek, you know, but it had two arms, two scar arms either side of it. And we couldn't really make it viable as a home robot. We sold them as standalone single arm SCARA robots, and they got used in laboratories for handling delicate parts and what have you in labs. And in fact, my son, I had a picture with my eldest with this robot in London before we went to Ireland, and he was there with the robot, putting his finger very tentatively, and my daughter as well, Kira, he was putting his finger in the gripper of the robot,
trying to figure out if he could get it to pour him a gin and tonic.
well, the funny thing was, we had this old picture, but these robots, that company's long gone and everything. But he kept searching, and didn't he find one of the robot arms on Craigslist out in America, and we had it shipped over and got it working again.
Oh, that's great. He got a bit of it back. Now, that business was sold, and you then moved into the aerospace sector.
Tim set up a new business and I joined him. But I joined him on the basis that I was planning to go to Ireland, and we developed the technology. It reduced the weight of the aircraft cockpit structure by about a third, which is huge in terms of cost savings in aerospace. So we decided we'd try and put the factory up for lightweight structures for aircraft in Knock. Everything was going fine, and that was a fantastic technology, and we had it on trial with Boeing and Airbus Industries, and it was really, really looking promising. And then, of course, GPA went to go on the market. We moved back to Ireland to set it up. In the midst of everything going well and loads of investors wanting to put money into the business, GPA went to go public, and I guess that didn't go too well. And
Tony Ryan's aviation leasing business and the flotation didn't happen. And
no, it was a disaster.
Were you in trouble then? Like, did you go bust?
Oh, yeah. We didn't go bust. We shut down the business, so we didn't owe anyone any money. But we basically lost everything we'd put into it. Yeah, it wasn't great now, to be honest. There wasn't much work around at all, but I could, as a design engineer, I always felt I could, whether it was aerospace, petrochem, whatever it was, I could have a crack at it. And I managed to get, through a friend of mine, Charlie Mulligan, he got me a contract with Mercury Engineering up in Dublin, who'd put in tanks into Libya, irrigation tanks into Libya, and they needed to put retrofit filtration onto those. And so I designed that. So I always say I designed tanks for Colonel Gaddafi, but really they were irrigation.
Put that on the business card.
Yeah, they were irrigation tanks, but that really saved me, because we were at that time I'd got a, I don't know if you remember, Premier Direct, I think, were the first people to offer home loans for home extensions on TV and all this. So I managed to get a loan for an extension on the house of 5,000 punts at the time, which kind of kept the bank from taking the house off me. They didn't know I had this loan, I guess.
So it was that tight and that close. I mean, were you having sleepless nights?
Yes, it was stressful. And I guess I wouldn't sleep very well. I'd be trying to think of solutions all the time. And Bernadette, my wife, then was worried because I wasn't sleeping. So I'd pretend I'd gone to sleep at night so she could go to sleep. And then I'd sort of be back thinking and, you know, jump up out of bed the first crack of light in the morning so that I could plan what I was going to do to get us out of the mess I'd managed to get us all in. And I guess for me, I was about 30 at the time, and I, as I say, I'd been working since 16 and kind of financially independent since then. You know, I hadn't borrowed any money off my parents or anything like that. I'd gone my own way, and my parents, and indeed Bernadette's parents, would have, if they knew how tight we were with the situation, they would have willingly given us money. But
you never told them.
No, we never told them. To me, it was, I guess that's pride, isn't it?
But obviously, so, as well, when you say the mess that I'd gotten everyone into, the reality was you'd set up a business, everything was going well, and GPA, its flotation collapsed. I mean, yes. You didn't really get anyone in a mess.
No, but, you know, you've got to take responsibility when things are good and when things are bad. And, I mean, that's the way I'd be. I made the decisions and, you know, took the chances, but it's fine. But then when it impacts on the rest of your family and, you know, that's tough.
The medical sector, which has obviously proven to be so successful for you with the company that you now have, how did you get into that? And what were you doing first?
Well, I guess, you know, after building the tanks for Colonel Gaddafi and doing a couple of other contract jobs, I was thinking...
Did he pay you, by the way?
Yeah, he did. He did. Things couldn't have been any tighter with pressure on the house, even just getting food in the... You know, it was really tight. And the check came through. I always say the check from Colonel Gaddafi, but I don't know who it came from, Mercury Engineer and all the department.
Well, if he hadn't have paid, I'm sure you wouldn't have fancied going over to collect that debt.
No. So, and actually the work was produced, the tank that I produced for filtration, I got designed and I got it built by IDT down in Inverin, Cunamarin, sent over to Tripoli. No foal, no fee that was, so... you know, until it was tested and worked, there was nothing in it. But I was kind of thinking, you know, Digital was gone, Wang, all these companies that came into Ireland, aerospace. But then the next wave was in medical device. And I decided that was probably a good industry sector for me to work in. So I looked around to get a job in a med tech company, an American med tech company, thinking I'd learn the industry and within 2 or 3 years I'd go out and set up my own business in med tech. And that's what happened. I went working for Puritan Bennett, as they were at the time, in Merview. Worked there on the development of a new ICU ventilator, life support ventilator, which was a fantastic project to work on. And I stayed a bit longer than I planned because I stayed to see the whole program through.
So the Aerogen business for you, the real break came when you developed this drug distribution system, this aerosol drug distribution system.
Yeah, so one thing I noticed, you know, and all the major ventilator companies, GE and Medtronic, Philips, all of them, the drug delivery systems they used for people that were on the ventilators were, although the technology that goes into a life support ventilator is probably some of the most advanced technology in the hospital anywhere, but the drug delivery to those patients is technology that was developed more than 50 years ago, very crude in terms of aerosol drug delivery. So I figured there had to be better ways to aerosolize and target the drug delivery directly into the lung.
So basically with that, the drug comes in through the breathing apparatus. It's through tiny particles that are being breathed in as opposed to a liquid form.
Exactly. And people have known for many years that the lung is an effective place to deliver drug.
Because this goes into ventilators, COVID-19 happens. There's a huge demand around the world to manufacture ventilators. You're already, you know, making this for some of the big ventilator manufacturers. Did you then find yourself, the business, overrun with the demand to turn these around?
Yeah, totally. I was actually, we'd seen... Obviously, in China, Because we sell product into China. We have an office out there in Beijing. And we'd seen the uptick happening in China in ICU because our system, our aerosol drug delivery system, is the only closed nebulization system for ventilators. So by that, I mean, when you put the drug in, you're not exposing the caregivers to any of the gas from the exhaled gases from the patient. We'd seen a huge uptick in China. And then, of course, across into Italy. And we've seen it was coming. So we were ramping production ahead of this because we felt there would definitely be an uptick in demand.
When you look at what Aerogen is doing now, things are moving on. The hunt is on for a vaccine. You specialise in drug delivery through yes. aerosols. You're working on a vaccine project at the moment with a drug company that's yeah. trying to develop a vaccine. What's that?
Yeah, we're involved with about 20 different drug company and research institutions in delivering antivirals and different drugs for patients in the ICU. And some of those are going to be released to market using our technology. But one of the really interesting, they're very interesting programs, obviously, but one really interesting program, we're working with one of the leading vaccine companies in an aerosolized vaccine. So if you can imagine, rather than having to inject patients, they breathe the aerosol in. And we've developed a station. It's like a pop-up station for aerosolization of vaccine where you can get patients through very rapidly. So this would enable huge mass vaccination programs to occur because that's going to be the problem. Like this company in particular, they calculate their manufacturing capacity to produce 500 million doses of their vaccine by the end of next year. They also calculate if they use the aerosolized route, they can vaccinate five times the number of patients because you only need about a fifth of the drug, we're calculating, of the vaccine, I should say, to inoculate the patient.
So when vaccines come and there are millions and millions of people around the world trying to get it, yeah. if this aerosol technology is used, what you're saying is it could be delivered more quickly because they would breathe yes. it in. And you wouldn't actually need as much quantity of the vaccine.
That's right. Probably we worked with WHO on measles vaccine delivery for the third world as well through inhaled route. And basically we figuring that maybe a fifth of the amount of vaccine required to trigger the immune response with the patient. So that would mean for this particular company, they'd be able to inoculate 2.5 billion patients. And we actually calculated they were looking at China, and we figured you could actually inoculate 2.5 billion people in China in 39 days if you work 10-hour shifts at 55,000 centres. So it all becomes logistically possible through this route.
So what about the future of the business, John? I mean, I read somewhere that I think this year you're likely to ship something like 3 or 4 million units yeah. of your aerosol drug delivery system. This vaccine project sounds like it could be enormous. What do you want to do with the business?
I want to create a great Irish healthcare business. I've no interest in selling the business. We could have sold it many times over. We've grown it from scratch, and I want to keep growing it. We're the world's leader in aerosol drug delivery in the ICU. We've set up our own pharmaceutics group working between California and Ireland now, where we have two drugs in clinical trials that will be Aerogen drugs. One of them I really want to see across the line is an aerosolized surfactant to treat premature babies. That would be one of the great achievements in my mind we could do. So I just want to keep growing the business. We're very successful. We're profitable. We put all our money back into the business. So money isn't taken out of the business like in a lot of companies. We reinvest back into R&D year on year, more money. And so we get more technology, more products. And I don't see why Irish companies always have technology companies need to be sold. You know, you can, why not grow a great company?
As someone who has seen the top and seen the bottom in terms of your own career and things going through tough patches, can you really empathise and understand what maybe a lot of business people are going through right now?
Oh, very, very much so. I have huge empathy for companies and businesses that have done everything right. It is very painful, and I guess we will come through it. The one thing I do know, having been in those ups and downs, you can get through these. It seems as though the world is collapsing around you at the time, but you can get through it. And, you know, the important thing is your family, your kids, you know, those are the key things, and people stay healthy through it. Come out the other side and go again.
John Power, Chief Executive of Aerogen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.